This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, author Luong Ung was invited to speak to a group of students at Essex High School about her experiences surviving the Cambodian genocide at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. Ung was just 5 years old when the revolutionary leader Pol Pot took power in the Southeast Asian country in 1975, emptying the nation's cities and forcing its people into communal farms. Money was outlawed, books were burned, anyone with an education or links to the previous Cambodian government was imprisoned or executed. By the time the Khmer Rouge government collapsed 4 years later, roughly a quarter of the Cambodian population had died from brutal work conditions, famine, disease, and execution. Among the lives claimed were Ung's parents and two of her sisters. But she survived, reuniting with her living siblings and eventually making her way to safety, first in Vietnam, then a refugee camp in Thailand, before eventually finding a new life in Essex Junction, Vermont in 1980. Ung now lives in Cleveland, but she was invited back to her alma mater to speak to students in Essex High School's Global Leadership Program last week, as a speaker with local roots who can also fulfill the program's aim for globally focused studies and cultural experiences. In the weeks before her arrival, the students had been reading Ung's debut memoir, First They Killed My Father, and watching the 2017 film adaptation she made with Angelina Jolie. The audience of roughly 80 students and many state and local officials gathered in the school's library last Friday to hear Ung, and we were invited to conduct the interview and record it. For today's show, we're going to share that conversation with you. First of all, does this bring back memories? Do you have flashbacks, maybe terrible flashbacks to high school?
It does. Just walking up here and some terrible flashbacks, some wonderful flashbacks. And I was sharing with a couple of students before, and I remember classes and teachers, but also where I made out. And that was fun, too. Wonderful memories.
Those could be terrible flashbacks as well, depending on...
It could be. But, you know, it was my choice, and it was consensual, so that
Excellent.
Was good.
Excellent. So most of the students here have read your first memoir, First They Killed My Father, and have perhaps also screened the movie and have been studying the time period. And so let's talk a little bit about your early childhood. You were five when the Khmer Rouge evacuated Phnom Penh, where you were living with your family. And you write vividly in your memoir about first walking and not understanding how long you were going to have to walk for and where you were going. And then living in various places with your family, always fearing for your lives, always fearing that you'd be discovered for who you were, who your father was, about becoming a child soldier. And I'm wondering if now, in situations like this, having to talk about that period of your life feels cathartic or difficult or both?
Yeah. It can be. And sometimes it's cathartic, sometimes it's difficult. But at least it's my choice. And that's the big difference, is that when I was going through it, I was isolated. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't express myself. I couldn't cry. I couldn't scream. I couldn't fight, because to do so would meant not only to bring danger to myself, but to my family members. And so now I'm okay. I try to honor the sadness when I feel it. I also honor the celebration and the joy when I remember it. And there is power in being able to claim your story, to claim your voice, to be visible, to know that this happened to you, and it was not your fault, and it wasn't anything I brought upon myself. If anybody should feel ashamed or embarrassed or ostracized by the abuses that we suffered, by the pain that was committed against us, it should be wholly, you know, belong to the shoulders of the perpetrators, not the survivors. And so for me, it's honoring. Also, writing was very cathartic for me. Before I started writing, the war and the genocide and the trauma existed almost like a dark cloud floating over my head that followed me everywhere I went. When I went to bed, when I went to school, when I tried to study geometry, when I tried to pass my tests here at high school. And I couldn't make sense of it. And it was just so big, and it would strike at a time that I couldn't control it. But writing was a process where I could take my pen and poke into the clouds above me and pull at it, one single thread of a story at a time, and put that onto the page and put that into my journal, into my diary, and therefore made the whole experience a bit more manageable. When you're able to see and make sense and dissect the story and put facts and information, names to the things that you are afraid of the most, you have power over it. And so for me, it has been a very life-saving tool.
And did it feel that way when you were working on the movie version as well? Because seeing it, writing it, and then seeing it visualized with actual young children who maybe resemble you at five can be a different experience.
It was. I before I went to Cambodia to make the movie, I was there for 5 months shooting the film. I was there on the set pretty much every day, and we shot in 16 different locations and worked with extras who were survivors themselves. Majority of our cast members, all of our cast members and most of our crews were Cambodians who either survived it, lived it, you know, or children of survivors. So it was all very emotional for us. And I was really afraid of how that was going to hit me. And so before I went out, I actually worked out really hard, made myself physically strong. And then I got there, and the things that scared me weren't the explosion scenes, weren't the mine scenes or the war scenes. You know, I understood them, but the things that really broke my heart were the scenes where they were shooting a scene where the family of nine sat at the table to have dinner. And it was just so beautiful and spiritual. It felt almost as if my family had come back to life. Because ever since the war, every time we had praying ceremonies, we're Buddhists, we would always leave an empty plate to invite the spirits of our lost loved ones to join us. But to see them, actually, all of us, at a dinner table together, just tore me to pieces. But it was really amazing, too, because I was never alone. When we went through the war, even though we live in a country the size of the state of Oklahoma, and 7 million of us went through similar experiences, and we slept in villages that were very tight, very crowded, we couldn't speak. We had to isolate ourselves within ourselves. And so you were together, but you experienced everything alone because you couldn't express yourself. And when we were at the movie set, every time I had an emotional moment, I felt a hand on my back, a small hand holding my hand. Somebody would stand next to me. It was all really magical and spiritual, and so I knew I was never alone, and I was able to do that for other people. We watched out for each other, and every time I saw a person, another person having an emotional moment, I would do the same thing. And it is true what they say. When you don't have to be alone, when you don't go through things alone, it really lessened the tragedy.
Many survivors who have seen the film have spoken about how powerful it was, so powerful for some of them that they couldn't stay, couldn't watch. And part of that was that it was shot in Cambodia, that it's in Khmer. But also some have talked about how healing it's been for them to have that kind of experience and to let the emotions wash over them. Is that part of why you wanted to make the movie and make it in Khmer and make it in Cambodia?
It is. I wanted so much to make it in Khmer. Now, the language is beautiful. Cambodia, as a country, is a nation with over 2,000-year-old history that built the largest religious complex in the world, the Angkor Wat, that has a rich history and vibrancy of arts and music and architecture and dance, and that is a nation that is so green, you know, that really I have not yet found that green color in a box of 124 crayons coloring in the sceneries. And so I wanted to also show a beautiful Cambodia where there's true love. One of the reasons I wrote the book, why I started writing the book, was when I woke up to the news in 1998, April 15th, that Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge leader, had died in his sleep. And then medias around the world aired his last interview, in which he often said that the thing he did in Cambodia, he did for love. And that phrase struck me to the core, and I was so enraged and angry at it. It was sacrilegious, it was blasphemy, because love does not commit genocide. love does not commit mass murders of 1.7 to 2 million Cambodians out of 7 million people. Love does not cause this kind of destruction to the land, to the soul, to the people. And so I wanted to write a story that negates that legacy. I want to tell the love of real love of what it looks like to father and daughters and sons and mothers and brothers and sisters and land and culture and history. And I wanted to do that in Cambodia in film, and I think we succeeded.
When you talk about love, clearly one of the most powerful relationships in your life was that of your relationship with your father and your love for your father. Could you describe him for us?
My father, I'm one of seven. And so, you know, my brothers were all so cool and older brothers, and they were all so busy with their bell-bottom pants and Elvis Presley music and their 8-track tapes and desperately trying to be cool. And my three sisters and I were very, you know, loud when we played and fought a lot. And so my mother was busy. She was raising all seven of us and many other extended families, so she was busy. But I was five. The age where I had enough verbal abilities to be cute to my father and to also manipulate my mother, and also knew that I could use my words to get what I want. And my father, instead of, like other people who thought I was a troublesome child or talked to my much, my father thought I was clever. And I grew up to want to live up to that. I knew growing up that I may not be the smartest, I may not be the biggest, but I was going to grow up to be clever. And that meant I had to be resourceful and resilient. And my father always said, every time I got into trouble and my mother got mad, he always said, but she got herself out of trouble. She found her way out. And and that's, it's so special for me. And he had the face of a moon. It was round with full lips and large brown eyes. But to me, the physical appearance wasn't even in anything I really hold on to. But it was the fact that he loved me and he thought I was clever and he thought I was special.
You talk in the book about how he called you a diamond in the rough and that, you know, the little polish you could sparkle. You also write about how you needed your rage to survive. You needed that rage in order to propel you forward. And when you get to a place like Vermont, and that rage may still be there but doesn't have the same usefulness, were you able to let that rage go? How?
I thought I needed my rage because I didn't know anything better. I didn't know how else you could be in the world. When I was growing up in the Khmer Rouge, and after my parents were killed and I ended up at various different camps and then at a child soldiers camp, the instructor of the camps would see the rage and say, that's a good thing. I didn't go to a school system like this where we have wonderful teachers who will take you aside and tell you, you know, you could become a leader. You could become a critical thinker. You could learn more about the global world. Instead, they put me in a field and put guns half my body's height, a third my body's weight. And then they put me in classes where instead of teaching me to be a leader, to be readers, to be writers, they taught me propagandas of who wanted to hurt me and how if I was to survive, I would have to hurt them. And so rage helped me learn that. They increased and they cultivated that rage. And it wasn't until I came to Vermont and met people like Linda Costello and her daughter Kim, who taught me different ways, and the teacher here at the high school and at the grade school who taught me how to make friends. I don't remember coming to America and in the third grade, and some kid called me a pain in the neck. You know, you don't do that to a child, former child soldier, and get away with it. Needless to say, I asked her what the expression meant, and I didn't speak English. She wouldn't tell me, so I grabbed her by the neck and punched her in the neck. I don't advocate that, but I didn't know how else to communicate with her. And I remember the principal didn't pull me aside and send me to school, but he actually pulled me aside and had a talk with me and how you don't act that way. You don't do that in America, and that there are different ways to act. Now I'm realizing that you learn the tools, but then you also have to choose to use this tool. Just because you have the tool to be different doesn't mean you get to be different. You have to choose it on a daily basis And that includes going out and driving and saying to yourself, today I am not going to commit road rage. Going to school and say, today I'm actually going to be kind. Even when people hurt me and I want to hurt them, I'm going to choose to be kind because that's my choice. And I'm not going to let anybody else take that choice away from me. You can tell probably that I'm a little bit of an activist.
Before you moved to Vermont, you had never seen snow. In fact, the closest thing that you had to compare it to was the shaved ice that is used in snow cones. And then you came here, and Jill mentioned that some of the students have been preparing questions for you, and I have some of them. And Sanju and Isaac want to know if you could talk a little bit about how you actually ended up in Vermont. And Livia wonders about what sort of culture shock you experienced when you came here, and specifically here to Essex.
When you are a refugee and you arrive at the refugee camp, you line up, and then there are refugee workers taking down your names and information and numbers, and you don't actually get to choose. Well, you do. You do choose. You can actually choose the countries you may want to go to, and I believe our first country that we wanted to go to was Australia, was closer to home. And then we chose France because we had family members there, and America was our distant third choice. And we didn't know anything about America. And at the refugee camps, refugee workers would try to show you life in America and what it was like by showing you movies on big screen in English that you, in a language you don't speak. For the global students who travel overseas, you know that movies that often makes its way to third world countries tends to, Asia now, even tends to be big budget movies with plot lines that takes place in big cities like Chicago or New York City or Boston. And I remember looking at the screen and seeing people with various different diverse colors of skin and hair, carrying boombox, wearing short shorts, weaving in and out of tall, shiny buildings. And then we were told we were going to this place called Vermont. And you all know Vermont is the whitest city, the whitest state in America. And this is statistically true. So we didn't know anything about Vermont. And we arrived June 20th of 1980. And it was cold. And we were told that it was going to get colder in this thing called winter in Vermont, in America. I have to say, when that first winter came, I learned all the bad four-letter words. Because it's really, not just really cold, I mean, it's really freaking cold here. But it was so, you know, we were so blessed, and we were sponsored by the Holy Family Church, wonderful people like Linda and the Lucentis, and so many people who showed us around how to take buses, how to use the laundromat, how to go to grocery stores. People introduced us to American food. We loved hot dogs. Don't understand at all, even to this day, what meatloaf is all about.
Neither do I.
Yes, you know, because in my country, spice is something that makes your taste buds burn and your scalp sweat. Ketchup is really not spice, even no matter when you put how much you put on meatloaf. It was really, really different. And I have to say, probably the biggest culture shock for me was when I was trying to learn English, trying to speak English. And you know, as young people, you know, you don't just learn English. You got to be cool. You want to fit in. You got to learn the lingo of the era, which unfortunately for me was the era of the Valley Girls. Which for you young people, you know, it's a language, a completely different language, where you start all your sentences with duh, and then you end them with gag me with a spoon. And as non-native speakers and also my first two languages in Chinese and Cambodian, I am often very creative with languages, and so I would come in and it's like, gag me with a fork, y'all. which does not work.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Natalie is wondering if your teachers and classmates knew what you had been through.
My classmates didn't. I didn't speak about it. A few teachers knew about it, but not very much. I couldn't speak about it. I wanted so much to have what my friends had, which I believe was safety, love, normalcy, to fit in, to be just like everybody else. That's all I wanted, just to be just like everybody else. And whatever that was different about me, I hid, and hid really well. And the toxicity of what happened to me was so strong that everybody, every time I try to speak, I would be so emotional that I would just burst into tears. And then I just thought the tears would never stop flowing. And the one time I remember here at high school, going through puberty, and you know, that's difficult enough, but then when you go through changes in your body and your mind, the stories came back in a way that I couldn't control it. And I remember going to see the school counselor here and could not talk about it, and then ran out of the class and right out of her office and went into the bathroom and vomited. And that was how and why I started writing. I could not speak the words. And so instead of vomiting into the toilet, I vomited the words onto the pages. And then I just started writing. Whatever that came up, however it came up, I just started writing.
You've talked about how it was a difficult time for you, and you had nightmares at night about your experience. You were trying to be as American as possible, and yet you couldn't really escape what you'd been through. Did you have therapy at some point, or was writing really your therapy that worked for you?
I did therapy when I went to college. In high school, it was mostly writing, and I think at that point, maybe it was Mrs. Costello, someone else gave me a book called, it was really a book that would become my Bible. It was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And it was such a wonderful book. And in it, I learned the art of logotherapy, of using writing as a form of therapy. And it's actually now being used in a lot of communities for survivors of traumas, for survivors of domestic violence, for people to rewrite their narratives and use it as a tool to heal themselves. But back at that time, I didn't really know much about it, and I'm so grateful that Mr. Franco wrote the book. And so for me, it was writing and reading. And I remember also, not much later than that, somebody else gave me a book that would change my life and change how I saw myself in the world and how I take up space in the world. It was Dr. Maya Angelou's book, I Now Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And her words taught me the most important lesson in life for me. And that was that, I've already said this, if anybody in our world should ever feel ostracized or ashamed or embarrassed by what they suffered and the abuse that was done upon them, it should never be the victims. That belongs solely on the shoulders of the perpetrators. And therefore, being able to cast off some of my survivor's guilt, some of the guilt of being here, of what I had to do to be here, of the people I might have harmed to be here, to take that next breath, that it wasn't my fault, it wasn't my doing. It was the fault of the soldiers and the war and the genocide.
Would you read a passage of your book while you're talking about the power and the value of writing and what it's held for you?
This is from First They Killed My Father, now a movie, streaming on Netflix, directed by Angelina Jolie, a little-known actress that I met many, many years ago. This is a passage that I love and describes my childhood. Princess Monine of Cambodia. Now, she is famous for being proper, Ma continues. It is said that when she walks so quietly that no one ever hear her approaching, she smiles without ever showing her teeth. She talks to men without looking directly into their eyes. What a gracious lady she is. Ma looks at me and shakes her head. Is my reply, taking a loud swig of Coca-Cola from a small bottle. Ma says I stomp around like a cow dying from thirst. She's tried many times to teach me the proper way for a young lady to walk. First, you connect your heel to the ground. Then you roll the ball of your feet onto the earth while your toes curl up painfully. Finally, you end up with your toes gently pushing you off the ground. All this is supposed to be done gracefully, naturally, and quietly. It all sounds too complicated and painful to me. Besides, I am happy stomping around.
I watched you when you walked in here. You don't stomp anymore. Writing and art have been very important in Cambodian culture and throughout its history, hugely important in terms of the development of the country. And then, of course, one of the things that the Khmer Rouge tried to stamp out completely, artists, writers, people who were intellectuals. Does that influence at all how you think about your writing in a long tradition of Cambodian creativity?
It does. Of the quarter of the people who perished in the war, in the genocide, from starvation, diseases, and hard labor, and executions, the soldiers targeted leaders and builders of the nations, the doctors, the lawyers, the architects, the Buddhists, the singers, and writers. And with that said, 90% of artists were estimated to have been killed during the war. And I believe the soldiers targeted artists because we are a group of people that they believe is are able to see what is beyond the here and now. We could see into the sky and the spirit, and we can see into the earth and the soul, and then we can put that into our art and our writings and our weaving and our knitting and our cooking and our writing, and that is spiritual. And so for me, writing started up as a therapeutic tool, but the more I did it, the more I wanted to create something that lasts. And I wanted to write the soul of Cambodia in the rhythm of the Cambodian language, you know, and also just the beauty of the Cambodian culture. Life is short. We may be here today, we may not tomorrow. But my words and my art will go out there and hopefully will last much longer. And I hope the beauty that we put in as artists will continue to affect others in such a way.
What does your family think of your writing and your legacy?
I don't have a legacy with my family. and it's right. It's absolutely right. We shouldn't ever focus on being a legacy to our family or to anybody, actually. I mean, I'm nothing special, and they are much more happy with the legacy of me as an eater of food. And I am somebody, when you cook for me, I am so joyful. I am so happy because I don't cook, and I don't like to cook. And if you cook, I can hop myself on a counter and with my glass of wine or Coke, entertain you with stories. Mm-hmm. And so that hopefully is a legacy that will last. They are happy that I've told the story. And I remember when I first published the book, when I first got the contract for First He Killed My Father, I went to Cambodia and I went to my brothers and sister, and I had printed a copy of the Universal Declarations of Human Rights. I was going to tell them all the ways why we needed to get this story out. And though it is our personal story, I wanted to tell them about the violations of human rights and about what happened to us was a crimes against humanity. It was war crimes. It was genocide. It didn't just happen to us. It happened to Cambodia as a nation. It happened to the world as a human race. And before I even had a chance to explain anything to them, my siblings gave me their permissions very readily. And it dawned on me then that when human rights abuse has been perpetrated against a person, that person knows, with or without information or with or without declarations of human rights, when wrongs have been done to us, we know. And we, when we tell the story of what happened, it is the right thing to do, and we do it because it is the right thing to do.
We have some other questions from some of the students, and Shradika wants to know how you think your experience have motivated you in your adult life, and we've been talking about some of how this has unfolded in your life. And Ella and Clara and Maya also want to know how this history, your past, now affect you in your daily life.
How it has motivated me is that my past does not define my future. And I was talking with my husband about it. When I was growing up, and when people heard of my story, I remember very clearly their kindness, their support, their love, their friendship, their extensions of many, many things that helped my family and I not only survive our wars and our genocide, but to thrive in peace. What didn't help was the pity. What didn't help was people feeling sorry for us. Because, you know, pity doesn't solve problems. Support and allies and assistance to help people who could then help themselves. So I think, you know, that kind of motivated me to be who I am, to show people that we are strong, that we are all strong, that we are all courageous, that it is all within us, that all we have to do is tap into it. And I think when people, you know, to show people that we are survivors and not merely victims. I've been interested recently and been giving some talks and some thoughts about the issue of resilience. Mm-hmm. And if you Google the word resilience, Google definition says it's an ability to bounce back, to snap back into shape, to overcome adversities and health concerns and break up relationships. And one of the example they give is elasticities. But then if you do a little bit more research and you read the work of people who study, who spent decades studying the topic of resilience, groups like the American Psychological Associations, and you read what they say about resilience, and they say you can cultivate resilience. It's a thing that is learned. It's a learned behavior. And what you do to cultivate and increase your resilience in life to help you overcome traumas and adversities is to cultivate your communication skills, your skills to manage feelings and intense emotions and stress, to build communities and build relationships where there's trust and love and faith. It is to be connected to one another. And it does not at all sound like resilient is something you do alone. It is something you do together. So it only makes sense that we do the work to build our community and our own resilience so that we can rise together. And so I think that's motivated my work as an activist, as a person, as an aunt, as a friend, as a community member, is to know, to show that we have the strength and we have the courage, but it amplifies when we do that together, when we be together, when we form and we join groups to do the work together. And in the U.S., there are over 1 million charitable organizations registered, many, many people trying to do good work. We don't have to do any of this work ourselves, and it is better we do it together. My goodness, my activism just coming out again.
That's great. Do you have advice for the young people who are here today on how to not only build their own resilience, but work in that communal way to strengthen all of us together? High school is a really hard time.
It really is. I wish I'd learned in high school that people want you to succeed. When I was in high school, and like many other high schools, there were people who were unkind. There were people who picked on me. There were people who, you know, I might have even picked on. And then there are the mean girls and the popular girls and the cliques. And I think what really harmed me and prevented me from having a better life was, in high school, was this belief that people were waiting to see me fail. That they were waiting to see this so that they could laugh at it. But in actuality, that's not true. It may seem so to you because there may be one person or maybe even 3 people or maybe even 10 people who are waiting to see you fail. But this is a school of 400 or so, however many students here. That only means that there are 390 other people who are waiting to see you succeed. Find those people and help them succeed so that you could succeed. And I really wish I've known that. I really wish I walked into the world, I walked into life, believing that people wanted to see me succeed instead of being fearful of failing. And also, fail is not a bad thing. I failed many times. When I wrote the proposal for First They Killed My Father, my agent sent it to 25 publishers. 24 rejections later. 24 rejections of 25. And that yes did not come in the beginning. The yes came pretty much at the very tail end. But it took just one yes. Education also is really important. And even though when we were, when I was in high school, I don't remember many of the classes I took or what I learned. But you know, the one thing I learned that I was able to take with me, maybe not geometry or algebra, But I took the skills of critical thinking. I took the skills of time management. And those are the work that I've been able to go out and succeed in college and succeed in life, and then wrote a book proposal and then got it published. And even before I got it published, and say to my publisher, you publish the book how I wrote it, or you don't have to, because I'm employable. I have a college degree. I know how to flip burgers really well at my years working at Wendy's. So I don't have to make decisions based on desperation. If we're here in America, very few of us have to make decisions based on desperations. Now, if you're in Afghanistan, if you're in Bangladesh, if you're in Cambodia, those decisions and choices are not available to others who may have to make decisions based on desperations. But we don't have to. Therefore, we don't have to live like it.
When you do your critical thinking now, do you do it in Khmer, in Chinese, in English? What language do you think about in your head?
It really depends on who I'm speaking to. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I think it's in English. And also, critical thinking doesn't have to come in words, right? You could do it in terms of food, which is a big thing. You could recipes, you know, that's it really requires thinking to put into that creation, creativity, just the ability. Critical thinking to me, it's not just language but it's anything that expands your horizon, your mind, and your universe. And I'm so very rarely bored in life. I love books. I love to read. I especially love books that teach me things. And unfortunately, I mean, I pretty much read everything except for romance novels and how-to books. I really have not learned that much in any few of the romance novels I've read. So for me, critical thinking is just open up your mind and just, it is the most amazing thing. And if you accept your mind and you love your mind and you support your mind, you will never be bored in your life.
So no romance novels, but let's take a very sharp left turn here, because after three memoirs, you're writing a novel, and I want to read what you've said about it. It celebrates Cambodian folklore and mythology, and you say it's about a headless witch vampire queen, and you describe the novel as the Walking Dead zombie apocalypse mixed with Buddhist mythology. I can't wait to read this book. When do we get to read it?
I just finished the first draft, and it is a lot of fun. And I wanted to have fun. I want to have fun with my writing, and I've come to realize that with three memoirs, you know, it hasn't exactly been fun. I wrote First They Killed My Father when Pol Pot died, and I wanted to tell a story of what it takes and to survive a war, to survive a genocide on a daily basis. And then I wrote Lucky Child when President George Bush landed his plane on SS Lincoln, speaking to a group of Navy men behind, in front of a sign that said, "Mission Accomplished." And so the activist writer in me came up and said, I needed to write a story of what it takes to survive the peace long after the wars has been declared over by journalists, by presidents, by writers. And then Lulu in the Sky, I wrote really mostly when I outlived my mother. The age she was when she died, and wanted to tell the story of what it takes to go from surviving to thriving. And so every book I've written with a mission of things I wanted to say. This one, I just want to write about zombies and vampires and write really cool fight scenes. And my protagonist is this 16-year-old girl imbued with physical skills and powers and heart and courage, and is able to act on it and do the things that I didn't have power to do when I was growing up. And then after I finished it, it turned out it's really a book about child soldiers. But I was able to write a story that deals a lot with child soldiers and combined it with the craft that I love, and with learning about mythology, with really writing about characters and love, and I even wrote a love interest. I was really uncomfortable writing love. I'm much better writing about wars and fight, and now I can write really wonderful fight scenes. But I had to learn to write about love in a romantic way. really, really strange.
Do you have a publisher? I mean, have your agents and literary agents and editors gone right along with you on this zombie apocalypse journey?
They have been very supportive. I've decided not to get a contract first. I want to have total control on what to write. My agents think we can put it up for biddings. Who knows? But mostly, I wanted, when you set a proposal, you invite other people to read your work, and then you invite them to have a say. And I wanted to be able to write exactly what I want, how I wanted to do it, and have no one else say anything about it. And I've been able to do that because I'm very blessed, because in addition to my work, my husband and I are in Cleveland, and we are partners in and owners of 3 restaurants and 2 microbreweries. So we make pizzas and beers, and so that allows me to work at our businesses and write when I want.
And not cook.
And not cook.
All right, do you guys have questions that you'd like to ask Luang? Want to start?
So my name is Cara Viglucci, and I'm a 9th grader here at EHS. And my question is, what was it like to work with someone else to try to portray your story on film? What was a challenge, and what surprised you?
I'm so, so, so blessed that I didn't just get to work with another writer. I got to work with one of my bestest friends in the world. And Angelina Jolie and I met when my book, First They Killed My Father, came out in 2000, and she was in Cambodia filming Tomb Raiders, and she said she picked up a copy of my book from a seller on the street, meaning she picked up a pirated copy of my book, meaning she owes me $5 in royalty, and then she called me up, and we just have been good friends ever since. And through the years, I've had studios contacting me wanting to turn the book into a film, and I've taken some meetings, and I had just not liked what they've offered and what they pitched. I've always known that if I was going to do and turn the book into a film, it was going to be with the right group of people, with the right integrity and with the right intentions, or I was not going to do it at all. And Angie is that person. She loves Cambodia. She loves, she has an adopted son, so it's very she's emotionally connected to the country, as well as spiritually and intellectually connected to the country. And so when we sat down to write the screenplay together, she's so talented. I took her lead, we just worked different drafts, many drafts. I learned a lot from her, and I think she'll say she learned from me. And I think the most important thing was that we knew what we wanted to put out, that we had an end game. And our end game was that we wanted to do a story that would honor the country, that would honor my family and the many, many families in Cambodia, that would honor the culture and even the land. We knew that we wanted to do a love story to Cambodia and not a war story of the Khmer Rouge genocide.
Gabby would like to know if the original script was written in English and then translated into Khmer or vice versa.
The original, because Angie doesn't speak Khmer or write Khmer, you know, so as a co-writer, we did it in English. And then the Cambodian cast and most of the crew do not speak English. And so we then had it translated into Khmer.
Angelina Jolie's son Maddox, who is Cambodian, worked on the film, right? Did he get the value out of it that she was hoping that he would by working and actually being a part of that production?
Oh, yes. He was great. He was great. He, I think he, being in Cambodia, being able to live there for 4 to 5 months, and for him, it's learning, it's not just learning the story, but also being with people who live on the land, so that he could be there to live on the land, see other people. And he was a big brother. He was a big brother to the cast members. And the little girl who plays me in the movie, she was 9. And and her whole family, Pax and Matt and all the, you know, the twins, and they were all on the set often, and they became a big family, and they just teased him. He played. He got to play with them. So I think, you know, he really did. He loved Cambodia, and we're all looking forward to getting back there soon.
Hi, my name is Greta Alexandra Parker, and I'm a ninth grader here. How has your experience as a survivor of war influenced your thoughts on current events and conflicts now?
We have power, and one of the most important power we have is the power to vote. This is not just our right. This is our power. This is our obligations. We should choose to. I think sometimes when we look around at what's going on around the world, what's going on in the U.S., we feel powerless, and then we don't do anything. And we have to step up. We all have to step up. We don't have to wait until we're 18. We can actually start. And I'm so heartened by what's going on with the high school students and high school students' movement around the country. I mean, speaking of that, just gave me chills. I wish I knew I had that power when I was their age. And to take that power to show our politicians, to show our world leaders that we are not going to take this, that we are not going to sit and just listen to their lies, that we will actually, that we know what we're worth, and that we know what we can do. It's made me share a lot more about my personal belief that in my personal growth and in my the healing of my own trauma, it is not enough to go inward. It is not enough to know about yourself, to heal yourself, to write about your trauma, your experience, and that I hope if you do, in the Buddhist culture, we believe that we will all suffer, we will all have to deal with pains, and then we do need to take care of ourselves. But at some point, hopefully you'll get to that point where you are just bored with yourself. You're not that special. You need to be able to take your feelings after you go inward, get outward, go wide, connect with other people, connect with other groups. When you're watching televisions, when you're at a school meetings, when your principal or teacher is bringing up issues and teaching you about things, listening to the vibrations in your heart, listen to which heartstrings twangs, whether it's in issues of Amnesty International or child soldiers or landmines or reading to the communities or, you know, environmentalists. Listen to the vibrations of your heartstrings. And when that vibrates, follow that to the issues that you want to work on, and then help make this world a better place for all of us. Not just for others, but for all of us, because this is it. This is our own one world, and if we don't take care of it, it is not going to take care of us. And we're really experiencing that now.
You said things are burning you up right now. You're angry. What specifically are you angry about? What specific issues do you see that are making you furious in American politics?
So every time I read anything about president, and I say president, I have to say my eyes roll a little, but he is the president. Every time I hear any more another stupid things he's come up with and said about the refugee issues, immigration issues, but especially refugee issues, it just makes me mad. This country is built on the power, resiliency, creativity, talents, commitment, work of many, many, many refugees. Albert Einstein was a refugee. Madeleine Albright was a refugee. You know, I am a refugee and was a refugee who came here and was given a second chance at life and who are now and had been and so grateful to the support of the American government for giving me Medicare, and for giving me support and food stamps when I needed it and I didn't speak English when my brothers and sister and I came. But we have since then been tax-paying citizens for the last 30-plus years. We contributed to America. We've made friends in America. We built families and communities in America. And my story is not unique. My story has been amplified and multiplied by many wonderful refugee families across our land in many, many states, and especially in beautiful places like Vermont. And refugees don't just build good communities in America and make good citizens in America. Refugees also are happily, and some of us, sending money in support to and to support family members in different places in our world, and therefore building good citizens and supporting people in those places that love America, that don't want to harm America, because they're being supported by American citizens who were former refugees who are now world citizens. And so, you know, we really, you know, what's going on right now, this misconceptions and all the lies about how we don't contribute to this community, it just makes me realize that people know so little about it.
Does that spark a question in any of you? I know some of you have written questions down that you were thinking of before this, but what are you hearing that you want to know more about? Come right up, ask a question.
I'm Augie, I'm a junior. This is kind of a long question. Do you have a message that you would like to leave for the students in the Global Leadership Program? Something you would like them to consider as we go through high school, college, and our early professional lives? And do you have advice about the skills, knowledge, and experiences we'll need in order to be impactful global citizens?
I'm so grateful, again, to the Holy Family Church, to the community at Essex Junction High School, and at ADL, and the church groups and the people who sent medicines to my family and I when we were at refugee camps, who sent blankets to us and helped us get here. Outside of the fact that they physically helped us, their work showed me a really important lesson that I take with me everywhere, and it is that peace is not an automatic. Peace is not something you wish for, and it's therefore granted. As global citizens, you global leaders, you know this already. Peace is not something you wish for and expect your teachers and your principals and your community people to give it to you. Peace is an action, or rather many, many, many actions. Peace is something you do on a daily basis, whether it's in your heart, in your community, in your home, in our world. Peace is something you commit yourself to. It's something you strategize to get. It is something you work for, and it's absolutely something you choose. Choose it, and then do it, and then work for it, and then find others who think and believe this and work with them, because that is how we will and can create a better and peaceful and safer world for all of us. And so it is something that we need to do. And when we do this work, it's a skill. Activism is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger you'll get. It's like riding bicycles. The more you bike, the better and more talented and able you'll be able to zip around. And so you have to do the work. You've got to gain the skills. And you have wonderful teachers who teach you how to put words together, how to write grants, how to communicate, I remember very well in high school here going to a class where we were taught to do interviews and learning how to do and give a really strong handshake. I took that with me. I remember I did it here. I didn't know, and I was taught to grasp somebody's hand, give it 3 strong pumps, and let go. And now every time I shake somebody's hand and they give me a limp little handshake, and I thought, that doesn't say much about you. Here, let me show you. Even little skills like that, every skill you gain in life is a skill that you can use. But you have to choose to learn these skills, because when you do the work of peace, you show people like me, many, many others, 160 million people who have gone through wars, and in our world right now, an estimate of 20 people who are being harmed by domestic violence every minute, which result in over 10 million people who have been hurt in their communities, in their home. You show people who've been hurt, maybe yourself who've been harmed, that the worst of man's inhumanity to man does exist in our world. But so is the very best of man's humanity to man. And that is in all of us. And when we show this, we can absolutely help heal scars and wounded hearts and make this world a better place for all of us.
Luang Ung, thank you very, very much for talking with us today. What a wonderful thing to be able to hear your words. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was author Luong Ung being interviewed before a group of students at Essex High School as part of the student's Global Leadership Program. Thanks to Jill Prado, director of the Global Leadership Program at Essex High School, for organizing the event and inviting Vermont Edition to take part. The show was produced by Rick Singeri and Matthew Smith. Ty Robertson provided on-site community engagement. Chris Albertine and John Billingsley provided audio and video recording of the event. Anna St. Marie was on hand to take photographs, and you can see them, as well as watch the video of the event, online at vpr.net. Mary Williams directed today's show, and our managing editor is Sam Gale Rosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.